Beth, what faith is and what faith is not. What faith is not, what faith is. And let me give you three things that is not faith. Faith is a terribly confused thing. We need to recognize really where we are today. The approach to everything, even in among Christians, involves two elements. Number one, it involves pragmatism. And second, it involves emotion. And you can wrap up most popular Christian teaching around those two things. Pragmatism simply asks this. What does pragmatism mean? It says, does it work? Pragmatism asks a question, which is, does it work? It is not the question, is it right or is it wrong, or but does it work? That is why, for example, a lie can be very pragmatic. As someone made up an extra proverb, they said, a lie is a very present help in time of trouble. Well, it's true. A lie can be very pragmatic. It can be something that works and works very well. But it asks the one question is, does it work? And if the answer is yes, then go ahead and use it if it works. Emotion simply says, how does it make me feel? Pragmatism, does it work? Emotion, how does it make me feel? And as you know, without a whole lot of illustration given, there's plenty of that out there. If this makes you feel good, and if you feel right about the course you're taking, that's all you need to know. If it makes you feel good, that's fine. That's the ultimate. And therefore, you come on with the philosophy, but that says, well, you do it this way, you do it that way, and for me to do it this way makes me feel good, and it works for me. And over here, someone else says, I do the opposite. But it's okay, because it makes me feel good, and it works for me. And you can go on and on and on and on to that type of thing. And that replaces the basic question for everything, which is it true? And that question ought to erase either one of those. Is it true? Is it right? And therefore, if something works for you as a lie, you don't ask the questions, did it work? You ask the questions, is it right? Is it true? Is it honest? Is it correct? And that is the question that was always asked with Christianity, but is not very much asked anymore. So what is faith not? What faith is not? Number one, faith is not optimism. Faith is not optimism. It is often called that. As though if you have an optimistic view of life, if you look at things on the cherry side, then this is a person of faith. It is not optimism. And there's a basic difference, which is this. Optimism can be defeated. Optimism can be disappointed. True faith cannot. Optimism can be disappointed. True faith cannot be disappointed. It is not optimism. It is not hoping for the best. Faith is not hoping for the best. I did not say that we should not hope for the best in any given situation, but that is not the same as faith. And third, and this is a big one, faith is not obligating God to do our plan or do our pleasure. And boy, are we ever, ever filled with this. I want to build a great building. And I have faith that God is going to move you to give toward that building. That is not faith. That is simply saying, I am trying by the word faith to obligate God to do my pleasure. And that is not faith. Faith is none of these three things. And I emphasize the third one because it's so popular. It is not a means of obligating God to do our pleasure. Now, there's one thing in this little remark that we should indicate. If our pleasure is to build a great building, we don't call it our pleasure. We call it what? God's will. God has told me that we are to build such and such, and therefore, but really, it is nothing more than your pleasure. If I would say to you, God is calling us to build a great building, massive building, and I would say, this is what God has called us to do. What would you do, I hope? I hope you would say, how do you know that that is the will of God? And the answer is, how do I know it's the will of God? I don't. But I would like it. It's my pleasure. And very often, that's a way faith is manipulated in something that is very, very wrong often. All right. What then, if this is what faith is not, and I think you've seen all of these, so-and-so is very sick, but they're optimistic about the outcome, and you say they're a person of great faith. No, they're an optimist, but optimism is not faith. Or, and this would be a normal, natural thing, to be in a situation and hope everything works out for the very best. We say that all the time. Have a nice day. We hope that your day works out nicely. That is optimism, and that's hoping for the best, but it is not faith. It is not faith. Third, faith is not saying, I want this, I want that, and making things come out right. It is not obligating God to do our pleasure. Now, in connection with the last one, let's look at Hebrews chapter 11. And in teaching these last verses, I'd like for you to note that there are two classes of people, both of whom had faith. But you know, men of faith do not always end life in pleasure. Men of faith are not men who obligate God to make things happen nicely. As someone put it long ago, I don't even remember who it was, happiness is when happenings happen happily. And that is truly the derivation, by the way, of the word happy. It comes out of the word happening. And when happenings happen happily, then I am therefore happy. And notice in this 11th chapter of Hebrews, you have, first of all, two classes of people. And you might either mentally or physically encircle them. Verse 33, who? That's all we need to know right now. Who? And then make an arrow down to verse 35 and connect it with the word others. Got it? Who? Verse 33, others. Verse 35. And the commonality between these two, the who, were men and women of faith. And the others were also men and women of faith. They have a common point. The who was faith people. And the verse 35, the others were also faith people. But notice the outcome of their lives was drastically different. The outcome of one set, the first set, was very pleasant. The outcome of the second class was unpleasant. Verse 33, who by faith, oh, this is pleasant. This is what faith does. Conquers kingdoms, performs acts of righteousness, obtain promises, shut the mouths of lions, quench the power of fire. Boy, that's real faith, isn't it? That's real faith. So let's go on and keep saying and seeing some more things that are involved in real faith. Escape the edge of the sword. From weakness were made strong. Became mighty in war. Wow, what faith. Put armies to flight. Verse 35, women receive back their dead by resurrection. Boy, that is faith, isn't it? Well, notice, so is this. And others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings, scourgings, chains, imprisonment, stone, sawn in two, tempted, put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, in goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom this world was not worthy. So notice the outcome, whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, does not indicate the presence or absence of faith. God is not obligated to cause our events of life to come out pleasantly. You say, well, haven't seen those things. What's the point of faith? If faith can't make things come out pleasantly, if faith can't deliver me from all of these miserable things, then what is the use of faith? Look back at verse 6. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. So the point is, how much do we care about pleasing God? Because you see, all of our conduct is really based on one thing, all of our conduct. Our conduct is based on our view of God. Our conduct is based on our view of God. If we view God as sovereign, then we'll act and think in a certain way because He is sovereign and so forth, and more about that later. Now, when it talks about in these final verses, some being stoned, some sawn in two, what did they do to deserve that? You say, well, it's obvious. They honored Jesus Christ. Well, yes, that's true. But here are some of the reasons Christians were put to death in the early centuries. And I'll give the lead reason. What would you say is the major reason why Christians were put to death? What would you say is the major reason? Now, we're viewing this from the standpoint of the people who put them to death. We're looking from the standpoint of the pagan. Why did they put Christians to death? And the first answer is in one word. Atheism. Atheism. They were put to death for being Okay, sorry, it's right. It's not crossed out. Sorry for misspellings, but the overhead makes glare. And if you don't look at it exactly right, you're writing and you don't even see what you're writing. But they were put to death as being atheists. He said, well, that's not, that makes no sense. Well, look at it from the standpoint of the pagan. The pagan always prayed to something. A rock, a stone, a piece of wood. He could not think of ever praying to an invisible God. And therefore, a Christian would do this. A Christian did not have pieces of rock or stones or something to pray to. Christians prayed to an invisible God. And therefore, here would be a Christian with his head bowed saying a prayer. And you'd look around and say, who are you praying to? I don't see anything. I don't see an image. I don't see a rock. I don't see a stone. You must not believe in God, do you? And therefore, they were put to death for being atheists. Now, in reality, they were anything but atheists because they believed in the one true God. And the one true God was invisible and unseen. But from the pagan perspective, they were praying to no one. And therefore, they're an atheist. They would say, for example, as we close the session this morning, if we would say, Our Father, they would not bow their heads. They would look up. And they would say, you're not praying to this idol? This one, this one, this one, this one. You're just looking up into the sky. And there's nobody up there. There's no idol in the sky. They would perhaps even look up and say, who are your eyes lifted to? And you would be, to their view, praying to no one. Therefore, you were an atheist. The serious repercussions of that is they were stoned for being atheists. They were sawn in two. And the pagan actually thought he was doing a service to God in putting you to death. Can someone direct us to a passage where we were told that this would happen? It just came to my mind. I hope it's right. John 16. John 16. And you have the clear-cut statement. Verse 2, they will make you outcast from the synagogue. But an hour is coming for everyone who kills you to think he is offering service to God. And therefore, Christians were put to death by people who thought they were actually serving God or gods, the gods, in so doing. And so this is one of the first reasons that Christians were put to death. They were also put to death. Their lives were taken. They were taken for rumor. How would you like to die for a rumor? Wow, that would take some grace, wouldn't it? Take something real to die for a rumor. Let me give you some of the rumors. In the New Testament, we have the command to greet one another with a holy kiss. Now, that was rumored into Christians are immoral. The kiss was a reference to a sexual orgy. And as rumors will be, the first rumor can be very flimsy. But if you ever notice, rumors are built on rumors. The second one follows. And someone came along a little bit later and said, not only do they greet one another with a holy kiss that involves sexual immorality, but they further said this. They have their communion in secret. Ah, that confirms the rumor, doesn't it? They do it in secret. And consequently, rumor built on rumor, and many were put to death for this. Then the rumor of the rumor was built on by another rumor. And that rumor was this. Oh, I saw some Christians go to their meeting place. And when they went, they took their children with them. There it is. Incest. Incest. And of course, that was a rumor built on a previous rumor. And consequently, Christians died for two things. Atheism or rumor. Another one that was built up that was rumor was, do you know, they heard the words of Jesus that said, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood. Another rumor. Christians are cannibals. Christians are cannibals. They drink blood. They eat human flesh. Now, I think all of those things are repulsive to you, are they not? Atheism is repulsive. Cannibalism is repulsive. Incest is repulsive. The idea of immorality is repulsive. And therefore, the killers of the Christians were wonderful. What kind of people? The greatest hatred ever directed toward the church, the true church, is from religion. And this was the reason, and I think we're sometimes a little bit shocked to hear these things, that this is why Christians were put to death, but they were the victims of much, much rumor. And by the way, in church history, we might just touch on this, out of this rumor and out of these unjust killings came a group of writers that wrote some of the brilliant letters to the emperor. And they explained, they were called the Christian apologists. Apologia, Greek word that means a speech in defense. And we had come along many brilliant apologists. And they wrote letters to the emperor. And in some cases, they got understanding as they straightened things out. So most of these apologists were not oral ones. They were men who were master of the pen. And as they wrote down and logically pointed out that these Christians are not guilty of the things that you hold them guilty of in any sense of the word. And they wrote great apologies. And therefore, you move into the era of church history called the era of the apologists. Now you might say, well, I would like to read some of them, and I can give you some to read, but you'll be very bored. I remember once hearing of the tremendous conviction that was brought about by the preaching of Jonathan Edwards, and one of his great sermons was Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And I was young in college, and I thought, well, that sounds like a real zinger of a sermon. I want to memorize part of that so I can preach it too. And you had people really that under his preaching were white-knuckled as they grabbed onto the seat, who would literally be in terror over the wrath of God. And I picked it up to read it. And oh, was it ever boring. It was just boring. And they said that Jonathan Edwards used to take his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, in a manuscript, and he had the kind of glasses that would slip down on your nose, and he'd slip them down on the end of his nose, and read line for line this very dry sermon. But it was an era when people really thought and took words seriously. And so if you read the apologists, you'll probably be a little bit bored. But they did a wonderful job of saying, Christians are not cannibals. That's not true in any sense of the word. But in closing out Hebrews chapter 11, in our few minutes that we have left, I want to emphasize the basis of faith. Faith is inextricably linked to content. Faith must rest on a basis of truth. Faith must rest on truth. Now, how do we know what truth is? If faith has to rest on truth, how do we know what truth is? Well, men have taken at least four paths to find out truth. Truth is obtained by thought. That is called rationalism. And what that says is this. Man, unaided by anything outside of himself, can arrive at truth. And that is the emphasis. The human mind is capable of knowing without any outside help whatsoever. Question, is there any rationalism around today? Do we have men who believe that my human mind, or the human mind, without any outside aid, with any outside help, I can find truth? And so let's make it down to a very simple statement. Rationalism says, I can find truth on my own. I can find truth on my own. And if it's not your own thinking, it's a thinking of someone else. I can find truth on my own. Much of those who hold to Roman Catholicism is rationalism. I know this is true because the thinking of the church has told me what truth is. Rationalism. I can do it on my own. Second, truth by means of empiricism. This is simply this. Truth can be found by experimentation. Truth can be found by experimentation. We might call this the test tube theory of reality. If you can check it out, if it works theory. If it works, and I can show you examples and proof that it really works, then it's true. Now, that's not to say that there's not elements in all of these that are important. Man will never discover truth without thought. By the way, you know God has set up things so that if you will not think, you will not know. If you will not think, you will not know. If you will not think, use your mind, you will not know. I'm jumping ahead now, but how did God's revelation come to us? God has revealed himself in a movie. God has revealed himself in a video. How is God reveal himself in a book? In a book. What do you have to do to get information from a book? You've got to read the book. And I think many of us as Christians say God has revealed himself in his word, and we forget to make the next link. His word is a book. A book. A book. You have to read the book in order to understand what the book says. So Christianity is very much a mental activity directed toward a book, a book, a book, a book. And therefore, what should we do in church? Book study. Study a book. Study Matthew. Study Hebrews. Study what the book says. Now let's add this, that due to, I think, TV and the visual, we are visually oriented today, are we not? We want to see it. We want to be vivid in the front of us. But as you, as a believer, must be basically a student of a book. A book. And books are written in language. Books have verbs, main verbs. They have clauses. They have adjectives. They have adverbs. And yet I've seen it over and over and over again. I will point out that in this verse, the main verb, and I almost get this, thrill us. Do something better for us than that. And you know what your problem is? You're brain dead. You don't want to think. How well do you think the type of teaching we do would go on TV? Some guy standing there saying a Greek word means this or that, or this is the verb and this is subordinate to this, and this is the main clause and this is a prepositional phrase that connects up to here. Oh, brother. Like there's an ad on, I think it's Dobson, on radio. This father asks his son, "Son, are you studying your Bible?" And the son says this, "Study? Yuck! That's boring." I want to think how sad that is. That's an ad. That's not a real person. But I have an idea that the attitude is kind of out there, is it not? Why do we, so apart for social reasons, have anyone say, "Oh, I'm so glad that school has started. I have a chance to think. I have a chance to study. Wonderful." No, we're brain dead, and consequently be dead to the truth that God has revealed in his word. Now, all these things are important, but they're not, I'm talking about the sole basis for determining truth, empiricism. Third, and today, is mysticism. And that means you have some kind of experience, esoteric experience, with an unseen being. You have some type of experience with the force, or something out there that's unseen gets a hold of you. And you've had this weird, mystical experience. And how much of that do we have today? Increasingly so, I think. That so-and-so meditated, and they meditated, and they went without food, and they fasted, and they meditated, and they had a vision, and they saw so-and-so standing out here, and they developed a personal relationship with the great, almighty, sovereign, omnipotent It. Ever heard of Jane Fonda? Her experiences? Mysticism leads to truth. Now, the Christian believes that none of these things are the basis. The Christian believes that truth is obtained by revelation. And it simply rests on this premise. It simply says that there is a God, and that God has chosen to open his mouth
and reveal himself, and he has done so in the Bible. If you believe that, you're really home free. Are those presuppositions? Yes, they are. Do I believe there's only one God? Yes, I do. Can I prove that? Well, oh yes, I suppose you can go to the various proofs of, don't you believe that someone made this podium? Well, doesn't the podium imply a maker? You look at a flower, doesn't it imply a maker? Yes, it does. But basically, there is one God, and that God has chosen to speak, and he's done so here. Give me those premises, and off we go. We are on the road to understanding what truth is. And faith is that which rests in truth. By the way, is it possible to believe a lie? Of course we can believe a lie. Well, that's why believing and faith alone is not the answer. Faith must be tied to revelation. And revelation is in a book. And this is where we build on a foundation that is sound. Out of that, or other than that, you only have left to your mystical experience, to a little experimentation, and to your own mind. And that, of course, is essentially a godless position, whereas revelation says there is a God who has revealed himself in his word. Father, we're thankful for your truth. We're thankful for your word. Help us to recognize that you have done it in a book. And therefore, we must read, we must think on what your word says to arrive at truth. In Christ's name, amen.